sell millions of records. In 92, she turned solo after a spell which began in 89, actually, when she said she'd never sing again. Just 3 years after that, the first solo record, Diva, received a huge thumbs up from everybody. 3 years after that, she went on to release Medusa, her album of covers of other people's songs, which included Wider Shade of Pale and Paul Simon's Something So Right. Both those albums have gone on to sell more than 12 million copies. It's 8 years after Medusa. Annie Lennox has been back in the studio with Stephen Lipson, who has been working with her since the Eurythmics days. And the result is Bear, which is a collection of 11 brand new songs written by Annie. Today we have the exclusive first play anywhere of four of those brand new songs and a rare interview with Annie Lennox, which we recorded 3 weeks ago now when we caught up with her in Boulder in Colorado, just north of Denver, where she was playing one of the gigs of her recent North American tour. So words from Annie Lennox next, but for the first time anywhere from Bear, her new album. It comes out June the 9th. Have a listen to this, Bitter Pill. The song is The Bitter Pill, and it's one of 11 new songs on the latest album from Annie Lennox, which is called Bear. And that's where you find us. Magic of Radio has brought us about an hour's drive north of Denver to a place called Boulder, where the sun is blazing through the windows.
Not.
And we're with Annie Lennox on Radio 2. Thanks for inviting us, Annie.
The sun isn't blazing through the window, dear.
It's, well, I think they're closing the airport because the snow's coming in. But I was just trying to give the magic of radio an extra lift, you see.
If only.
Listen, I've only had this album a couple of days, but I think I've got to know it quite well. And we've just played The Bitter Pill, and there's a couple of lines that really leap out. One is, how can I abide the taste of rage and anger burning me inside? Can't you see I'm relatively twisted?
Mm-hmm.
You don't look relatively twisted.
It's a tongue-in-cheek kind of thing, you know.
Is that what this album's about, though? Because I've read a bit about it, and you seem to be getting rid of some heavy baggage. Is it your way of dealing with life?
Well, songwriting is a process, you know. I mean, and it is something that comes from within. I haven't been writing songs to get rid of heavy baggage, necessarily. I think you have a lot more work to do with heavy baggage than just writing songs about it. But it certainly contributes.
There's some strong emotions, and it's a very, very emotional album. Did it start that way, or did it just end up that way?
Ah, it's really hard to say. I mean, I think that music is an emotional experience. It certainly is for me, and songwriting has to be a place where you touch on emotions, and that's what I respond to when I go to write at the piano.
I was quite surprised, because Diva was your first solo album. That was, 11 years ago. And then Medusa was you doing cover versions of other people's songs. So this is only actually your second solo album.
Self-penned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy the luxury of just being able to write when you want to write and release an album when you want to?
Yes, I do. Because Dave Stewart and I, you know, we made so many records, and we usually made one every year and made a tour every year. And that was my lifestyle for many, many years. And eventually, I tired of it. I started to want to have a family sort of situation and a more ordinary life, if you like. Unfortunately, I now have two daughters, and when that happened, I didn't feel it was appropriate anymore to be on the road and making an album every year, because that's incredibly consuming. So I just stepped back.
But you'd done it anyway by that stage, hadn't you, really?
Well, I had done a lot, but, you know, if you still feel like you want to express yourself musically and lyrically, then it's there and you can't avoid it. I mean, it seems to me that I must be some kind of singer-songwriter-performer, otherwise I wouldn't be able to do it now as I'm doing it.
Presumably, if you want to stop performing, you can, but presumably as a writer and as an artist, you keep on creating and writing, don't you?
I was busy sort of up in the middle of the night with babies and things, so there was quite a period when I just didn't. I just stopped. I just had a change of life, really. And then there comes another point where I feel right now that I kind of want to reassess it and see whether I can write songs. It's a bit of a challenge as well, you know. Every time I sit down to write a song, I'm not convinced that I can.
So you're quite deliberate about it. You sit down and write, I'm going to write a song. It's not like
no.
You wake up with things.
No. But I get myself into a situation where I can try. And if I sit down and say I'm going to write a song and it's going to be about this subject, it never seems to work. I do get myself down to a little room where I've got a piano and I can close the door and get into that creative space.
Because it's very powerful. I love the fact that music, that old cliche, the soundtrack to your life and stuff, but watching the audience at the gig the other night you did in Boulder, not only did they know the words and stuff, but they seemed to know the mood of your mood when you wrote those songs, and they seemed to have tremendous empathy with you.
Well, I guess that's the gift or the power of empathy and songwriting and this sort of connectiveness that you hope that you will have with an audience. I mean, when I came off stage last night, I was talking about it with some of the people in the band, and I was saying, you know, for years and years we played to audiences that were indifferent. They didn't give a damn who you were on the stage. You had to prove that you were of interest to them. You had to pull them in. You had to work really hard to get people's interest. And after a little bit of hard work and over the years, eventually people sort of start to get a little bit of interest in you. Maybe they've heard some of your music. They maybe decide they're going to buy a ticket and come and see you, but they're still not 100% convinced that you're worth listening to. So you've still got to work at them. But when you have an audience like the audiences that I have now, 12 years down the line, these people are coming to see me, but they know the songs, they know every song, and they know more or less what to expect. To play to an audience like that, that are already convinced that you are worth listening to, is a fantastic thing, because it's like putting a kite up in a fantastic wind space where you can watch it fly.
We're with Annie Lennox, we're in Denver, and I'm going to play, can I play another track from your new album?
Why don't you go ahead?
I like Honestly, and can you tell us why you're being so honest?
Honestly, this song is like a dialogue, but it's like an internal dialogue. There are two lyrical pieces that are going on at the same time. When one listens to one's own mind, you very often discover there's not just one voice talking or thinking, doing the thinking. There might be two or maybe even three or four. It just depends on, you know, how ill you are. But I think, I don't know about any other person's mind, but I can certainly vouch for my own, and I can say that there are certain different dialogues going on, and particularly if you are conflicted, and that this song tried to sort of present that. So you've got the one main melody line going on, and then you have the afterthought sort of response. So I used it like a sort of call and response type of structure.
Well, just north of Denver, if I say Boulder, people are going to say, there, you're not in Boulder. Have you been here before?
I haven't actually been to Boulder before, but I've been to Red Rocks. We played in Red Rocks years ago.
You've picked venues that are very, very intimate, and you've picked venues where you don't really have to shout. Do you know the venues beforehand, and was that a conscious decision?
Oh, it was very much a chosen decision. We had someone who represents us have a look around the country and really select appropriate concert halls, really. They hold up to about 2,000 people. And they're, as you say, they're very intimate. And what it does is it creates this wonderful atmosphere in the audience, I think. And they really feel part of something. There's no kind of hype or super technology. I use a screen as a backdrop, but it doesn't sort of blow up my face to a massive degree. You know, it's not the sort of thing that you normally do in an arena. So I think it creates a lovely personal feeling, and I think the audiences seem to go away with feeling that they've really experienced something quite directly.
Especially last night, the impression I got was that you weren't frightened of touring anymore. And the impression I get from reading about you is that you've done the tours and you've done the stadiums, but you were always sort of very, very nervous.
Yes and no. I mean, it used to be very much a sort of love-hate relationship, because it's a lot of hurry up and wait, and then a lot of hurry up. And you have to be so focused to perform, because there are so many things to remember and there are so many distractions around you. And I used to get terribly nervous, and I mean, I still do get rather nervous before I go on stage, but I've decided that it doesn't pay to go too far down that line, because once you've decided you're going to do it, it's like a jump or a leap of faith. You've got to do it, really.
How long does it take, having got on stage, for you to feel entirely comfortable then? Do you know when the minute you walk on, you think, yeah, I've got it?
Well, it depends. At one gig, I tended to forget a few words, and that made me paranoid that I was going to forget words for the next few gigs, and that made me nervous. But then after I'd run through it a couple of times without forgetting the words, I knew that I could, and then I forgot that bit. So it's, I mean, surely tennis players and athletes must feel the same way, because they have to train to focus mentally on what they're doing. And I feel it's very much like that. I mean, it's very physical, because the concert lasts 1 hour 45 minutes, and I don't stop singing and moving the whole time, basically. And so one has to be very strong to do it, you know.
When was the first time it suddenly hit you and you realised that you were famous and people recognised you wherever you went?
I can't really remember one specific moment, but actually, having said that, I do remember that Dave and I lived up in Crouch End in North London, and there was a sense that people might know my face a bit, and there was just a vague sense of that. But, you know, that started happening when I was about 25, and that's almost half my life, so I've become used to that. But I'm also not someone who really wants people's attention in the street. I don't want it at all. I mean, I really like to be anonymous, and I just really like to mix in with everybody else, and I don't see any reason why I shouldn't, or why would anybody want to stand out from the crowd in the street. I can't see any advantage in that, really.
Don't read OK, you know, or Hello, then.
Well, I used to, but I stopped reading that. For me personally, I just, as I say, you know, I have two kids and I've had this really kind of quite ordinary sort of existence, if you like, and I quite enjoy that. So maybe I'm being a bit ambitious to kind of want both things, and I know that by making an album, it'll raise my profile again because I'll come into the public perception, but at least it's based on my work and it's not about, you know, what dress I'm wearing or what film opening I'm attending or some kind of opening of a paper bag. And you know what I'm saying? I think there's an awful lot of celebrity around and it's there to make money, and it's not what I'm interested in.
But I've always associated you with striking images from the early days of the Eurythmics album covers. There was the orange hair, the bandit mask, and then this with the solo stuff, there was the Mickey Mouse ears, I think, and other things. So you're obviously very aware of the image, but are you aware of the way that the image is received and how
people
understand?
Well, those images are, in a way, they're sort of tools or masks for me. When I feel somewhat like an actress, because when I become who I am on stage, it's more or less a persona. I mean, it's me, but it's a much more heightened sense of me. It's not the average me, obviously. Mm. I don't walk around the street wearing Mickey Mouse ears or a great big red slash across my face.
I can't believe that.
Yes, it's true. I've rather outgrown it these days. But I enjoy that. I enjoy using that artifice, if you like, to project something and to project ideas. But there is a distinction, obviously. Yeah.
Who did the artwork on the album? Because you've been into self-portraiture for some time.
My friend, Alan Martin, he's a graphic layout designer. And a couple of years ago, I decided that, you know, if I was going to do anything visually, that it would be fun to ask him if he would collaborate with me. And he didn't know how to take professional photographs. I mean, just sort of taking snapshots. But I knew that he had the technology and the wherewithal to kind of to do this with me. So we just worked together as a partnership. And over the last couple of years, we've been taking pictures and experimenting. We have a lot of fun doing that.
Tweak them.
Yeah.
Okay, let's play another track from the album. Can I play Wonderful? No, I'm going to play Wonderful.
Why are you asking me? Just play it.
I'm just going to play Wonderful. Why are you feeling now wonderful?
I think human beings are paradoxical and full of contradictions. And I know that at times when one is feeling incredibly sad, one can also be appreciating some kind of beauty. Or when one is very happy, one can also be feeling another. I mean, we're like that. It's convoluted. It's not straightforward. So, I mean, the song Wonderful is about a kind of unrequited sort of love, if you like, which is the one in one sense, ecstatic. In the other hand, knowing that it isn't right, it's never going to work. So it's a song about that. I mean, I remember an interview with David Bowie that I read years ago, and he said probably all his songs are about unrequited love. And I thought, yeah, so are mine. That's what it's about. It's about hankering after fulfillment, completion. These kind of things.
Before, all about unrequited love. We're with Annie Lennox, and we're in Boulder, in Colorado, at the tail end of what seems to be a massively well-received American tour.
Incredibly, really extraordinary. The audiences here, for me, are just out of this world, actually. They just every night they just give standing ovations all the time. And okay. I'm very touched by
it's
it.
Good start.
It's very good.
I can't believe this is your first solo tour. Because you didn't tour the last album, did you? You did one gig in Central
Park.
No.
Well, I had two very little children and I just knew that I couldn't get on that bandwagon. But now I feel like I want to, you know, I just want to kind of take it because I haven't ever done it before. Strange as it might seem, it is different than being in Eurythmics, and it is a whole other sort of aspect. Although it's challenging in a way, I'm quite enjoying taking it on, you know.
Of course it's different from being in Eurythmics, but I mean, how did that feel looking back now? You were so famous so quickly and the pressure was so high for so long.
Well, actually, you know, having said that, we'd been in another group before. We'd made three albums and we toured a lot. We became kind of pretty famous in 1984 when we released Sweet Dreams, and in America it just went shooting up the charts, I suppose. And it was a feeling like having hammered on a door for a very long time, finally it slowly creaked wide open, and what was beyond was kind of scary because I didn't know what to expect. You know, I didn't know what this roller coaster of being exposed privately into a famous kind of platform what that really meant as a lifestyle, if you like. You know,
there must have been fun bits.
Of course. But by and large, I think for women, it's a bit different, because I think for men, there's lots of fun bits. By and large, my existence really is not that glamorous, although it looks that way from the outside. Actually, it's a lot of hard work. And basically, I go from one journey into a hotel room where I'll unpack, wait to go in a car to or a bus, do a sound check, wait after the sound check for a couple of hours to do a concert, get onto a bus, travel on to another city where I have to go into another hotel room. So it's really endlessly like that. And also because it is so exhausting physically, and to sing is very physical, so I have to really conserve my energy. So it's like I can't really go and party, whereas men can.
There you go, Dave. It's all out in the open now. What do the girls think of what you do then?
They're their own beings, and they're very independent. And, you know, they didn't know the full extent of what I did until about 4 years ago, when Dave and I went on tour and took our families a bit with us. And it was a bit of a shock, you know, because it was embarrassing. What are you doing? What do you think you're doing? You know, I don't think this is right. So I think they're getting used to the idea that this is something that I have done and I am doing it now. I don't know how long I'll do it for and if I'll continue doing it. I never know. I like the fact that I can do what I do if and when I feel like it. That is what you might call having paid your dues. I feel I really have, and I think I've earned this.
Danny Lennox, and we're in Boulder, in Colorado. So it must be about 25 years, I reckon, and you've been in the public eye for the best part of a quarter of a century. Looking back now, you say in the Eurythmics years are a bit bonkers, and now you're much more mellow. are you wiser as well?
I'm trying to get there. I think what happens to an adult who has the great privilege of having children is a huge turning point, and it certainly has been for me. When you have to take responsibility for other human beings that you love and cherish, and you want the best for them, and you start to look around at the world in a different way, and you start to look at yourself in a different way, because you have to be kind of exemplary and you want to be a positive blueprint. So having children absolutely changed me for the better, I hope. And it made me more introspective. It made me question far more about my own beliefs and thoughts and actions and who I am in the world. And really, when I became 40, I started to be, in a sense, a little bit more, even though I've always been quite introspective, I started to be a little bit more analytical about my own thoughts and feelings. And I just work on that. It's like a daily thing, you know. I think if you were to take a cross-section of people of my generation, most of them would have been through all kinds of quite harrowing experiences, as well as good ones. They might have been through illness, loss, bereavement, you know, divorce. I mean, I've been through quite a lot myself, and I don't think I'm hugely different from the ordinary person in the street. It's just that when it gets put down in print, it looks a lot worse, actually. So I identify with those kind of experiences, and they've informed me very much, all the heavy things that have happened to me or been part of my life's fabric. So as a songwriter, I put them into my songs, and I know that that's what people identify with in me, that I touch on quite emotional places for them. I don't give answers because I'm not wise and I don't have answers myself, but the fact that I'm seeking and that I'm always asking questions makes me alive and makes me what it is to be real, you know?
It goes back to the luck thing I mentioned earlier on, because a lot of people think, you know, you've got a good life and you feel, wow, I'm doing all this and I'm doing something I enjoy, and I can bring up the family and still do something I enjoy. And then they somehow think that, well, maybe I'm too privileged, or maybe I've got to pay my dues somewhere else.
Well, it's good. It's a healthy thing, you know, because we can take so much for granted. And it does look to people, very often we look at others and we look at them from the outside, and what we see is maybe perhaps that they're doing very well, and we envy them because they have a bigger car or a bigger house or 4 holidays a year, whatever. But we don't know what's going on in the inside. And I can tell you that you can go to the most luxurious holiday resort in some desert island somewhere, but if you are not at peace with yourself and content, then you are going to suffer a kind of nightmarish time. And I can talk from my own experience. I know that all is not well in my world necessarily just because I have material things that maybe make one's life more comfortable. I have to agree to that, no question. It's great to have money in the bank and not to have those worries, you know. Well, I've known what it's been like to be poor. I mean, most of my life I didn't have any money, and the money came, and it was like, wow, what do you do with this? And how do you use this responsibly? And is it okay to buy a picture that's worth a few thousand pounds? And should I buy a big car, a little car? What do I do? Maybe I should just go on a bicycle. Well, that's maybe not so simple because people are going to recognize you in the street. You know, when you become famous, you are somewhat marginalized, and you have to accept that. And I take it with a lot of pragmatism.
I don't associate you with that cult of celebrity. I'm famous because I want to be famous, rather than people know me because of what I've done.
I get invited to
everything.
Galas, and everything. I get invited to everything. More or less, I always say no. Because I know the deal. I know what the deal is. The deal is the red carpet. The deal is the paparazzi. The deal is get your picture in the paper because you want the publicity and they want the publicity and it wants to be associated with their thing.
Yeah.
And frankly speaking, do I want that? Not really. I'd rather be at home with my kids.
Well, you can't wear the same frock twice.
But they will give you a free frock if you want. But there's no such thing as a free lunch. And I know that too. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if you start to get associated with some kind of brand name, then you have to know that you're going to have to be the face for that thing, and you're going to have to live with that. And I don't want to be a clothes horse for anybody. I never did.
The Eurythmics gig you did, the tour you did when the last album came out 3 years ago, all the money went to, amongst others, Amnesty and Greenpeace.
It was divided between the two organizations.
And you were involved in Shelter?
Yes, I was,
and the Tibet campaign, and presumably countless others. This is where a strong image does actually help and can make a difference.
Yeah, I think so. I try very much to respond to everything that I receive. I don't put them in the bin. And sometimes I feel very much like the little Dutch boy with the finger in the dam, knowing that there is so much out there, and there's so much of a need, and that I can't do everything, and otherwise I spread myself too thinly, and I kind of devalue any value that I might put to things. But I try my best to respond appropriately to everything that I'm asked to do. And I also have within myself this kind of need to give back, because it feels kind of purposeless to simply go around feathering one's own nest all the time, which is fine, and I have a very nice lifestyle and I like it. I'm happy to have it, but at the same time, I hope that I can be of benefit to other people, and I try to do the right thing, you know.
Do you feel sometimes that you maybe have got lucky to a certain extent?
I think really my luck was that meeting Dave was that he had the kind of drive and belief in himself and in the music that we were making at the time that stayed the course, whereas I tended then to be far more pessimistic, and I would just kind of give up far more easily. And he's quite tenacious. So the combination of our two personalities lasted. Whereas I don't think, like I say, if I'd just been on my own then, I just think I would have given up. It would have looked ridiculous, you know, because at the time I knew that I was a singer and possibly a songwriter, probably a rather poor one at that. But I did long to write songs and make records, and I wasn't sure how to go about it, you know. And there isn't one particular way of doing it. There isn't a formula, as much as record companies wish there could be. There really isn't.
This album is, well, I suppose it's 11 years since the last one. So do we have to wait 11 for another one?
I don't know. I mean, it's never planned like that. I just, like I say to you, I'm so privileged because I just do what I want, when I want, and how I want to do it. And so even if I'm contracted to the record company, bless them, they have to wait too.
Thanks for inviting us over. It's really great to see you. I want to play A Thousand Beautiful Things, which is the first track on the new album. Why is this the first track?
Well, I think it's a beautiful way to start it off because it's kind of optimistic, and it's a song about gratitude, really. A lot of the songs on this album are, you know, I admit, yes, hands up, they're rather dark, but they're not nihilistic and they're not defeated. They have joy in them, a great deal of beauty also, and that represents me. That's how I feel about life, that it has a shadow side and it has a beautiful white light side, if you like. And A Thousand Beautiful Things acknowledges that there are dark things in the world, but at times I need to, like everyone else, see the beauty in it, or otherwise, what's the point in living? It gets very hard. And in that gratitude for life, one finds the reason to carry on, you know.